Sai Ram, dear listeners, welcome to this week's episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show where I invite questions from you listeners and search for and discover answers together from Swami's message and teachings. Greetings to all of you who are observing Mahavir Jayanti, the birth anniversary of the great and the last of the 24 Jain Tirthankaras and the founder of the religion of Jainism. If you want to know more about this great soul and the religion of Jainism itself, do listen to this week's afternoon satsang once it's made available for download sometime tomorrow. Arvind and I had a discussion on that theme this afternoon. Well, it's another beautiful and holy Thursday evening, and I have, as always, an interesting question lined up this week. The answer may or may not be new, because I guess sometimes the questions appear different, but the fundamental issue is more or less similar to other situations we might have addressed, especially on this show before. But I guess every question is but an opportunity for us to delve deep, reiterate and remind ourselves one more time of Swami's message, isn't it? So even if it is repetitive, I think we should not be too worried about that. But we will get to the question in a short while. But let us begin by offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And let me walk you through an interesting quote that I have for you. The words I wish to share are those of a very noble thinker and a freedom fighter from India, Vinoba Bhave. I quote, "I am convinced that those who get themselves involved in the machinery of power politics, even for the purpose of destroying it, are bound to fail in their purpose. To destroy it, we have to stay out of it. If we want to cut down a tree, it is of no use to climb into its branches. The desire to keep contact with something, even to destroy it, is a subtle and insidious illusion." End of quote. Well, these are deep and profound words. I don't know if I would be able to do justice to them. Nevertheless, let's try. Oftentimes, when we see the misuse of power, when we see the insensitivity of authority or selfishness of those who wield that power, we get this thought that how I wish I had the power, I would have acted much better. Or we think that when I have the power, I will change the system itself. I guess as a thought, it may not be wrong, but it comes with a paradoxical belief that power is all-powerful. We think that power is all that I need and it is all-powerful and I can change everything if I have it. But the truth is, power is indeed all-powerful. It overwhelms even the wielder of power, and that's the whole problem with power, isn't it? To challenge power, we don't need power. We need purity of intent. Like in that beautiful analogy that Vinoba Bhave gives us, When you want a tree cut, you don't climb the tree. In fact, you stand by the side of the tree and try to chop it, right? Same is the case with power. Power and authority is something that changes the nature of a person itself. I'm not saying that power changes everyone, but certainly the mildly selfish tend to become more selfish when given power, isn't it? Some may be diffident to do wrong or remain disciplined only because they are under authority. The harm that power can do to such individuals is truly enormous. Even when we were children, we would be asked in school, what would you do if you were the Prime Minister of India? Almost giving us the idea that it was only power that stood between us and the great good that we could do. But that is an illusion. If I cannot think selflessly when I have no power, I will not think selflessly when I get the power. So it is not that we must abhor power or power and authority is evil. We must focus on purity, inner purity and purity of intent. If we are at some point chosen to play a role of power, I think our mind will then be well sealed and protected from power. It is then that power can become a tool. But if we start with the idea that I can do so much if only I had the power and authority, and we labor to achieve that power impatiently, there is no guarantee that we will use it rightly. And may I also add, not all forms of authority have to be resisted too. Some of it is meant for our own growth. And to recognize such good authority and power, we again need inner purity. So it is always better to strive for and pursue purity and selflessness. Unrighteous power fears nothing as much as it fears selflessness. So to battle power, we don't need power, we need selflessness and purity. That is what counters and thwarts the might of power. To discriminate between good and bad authority, we again need inner purity. And finally, we need purity to keep ourselves stable if eventually we have to assume the mantle of power and authority. So before we head to the question of the week, permit me, dear listeners, to read that beautiful quote by Vinoba Bhave one more time. I quote, "I am convinced that those who get themselves involved in the machinery of power politics, even for the purpose of destroying it, are bound to fail in their purpose. To destroy it, we have to stay out of it. If we want to cut down a tree, it is of no use to climb into its branches. The desire to keep contact with something, even to destroy it, is a subtle and insidious illusion." Well, let's then head to this week's question. We've already started late thanks to the program in the Mandir. The question today is from an elderly listener, Mrs. Leela Mahadevan from the United States. It's a lengthy question that she sent us through email. I have Sister Sumana to read it out for us. We'll listen to the question and we'll see what answer we can come up for that.
Sairam Deoprem, in 2010, a lady who is living in Puttaparthi, opposite to the elementary school behind the Pathamandir, looted all my things like vessels, clothes, etc. when I went for lunch in the Mandir. When I came back, the room I had taken for rent from her was vacant. When I asked her, she said she didn't have any idea. I was wondering how she could have stolen my things when I had left the room to the care of another person who was introduced to me by an acquaintance as trustworthy. The same evening, when I went to ask her about the sari I wore in front of Swami during the 2009 Christmas carol singing, she initially denied, but later threw it to me from her cupboard. As I had to leave for the US, I did not have time to lodge a complaint. Till now, I am unable to digest this incident, as I have been carrying these things throughout my life to different parts of India and have fed many, many people with love. My question is, why did Swami keep quiet, just a few feet away from his abode? We come with a hope that in God's place, there will be good people, honest and trustworthy people. Can I take it as a planned loot? Or should I take it as a divine leela of teaching me a lesson that attachment to things is a maya? Or that my karma was washed away? What would be the Lord's answer? Thank you.
Well, that was the question that she sent to us, and if I were to rephrase the question or just give you the essence of whatever was mentioned by that listener, I think it's primarily about three questions. One is, why do bad things happen to us, especially when we have been good and we have served so many people? And the second question is, why do bad things happen in God's abode, in Swami's proximity, around Swami and in Swami's place, in Swami's Puttaparthi or Swami's ashram? And the third is, how do we recognize what the lesson is in this whole episode? When something happens like this, how do you know what is the lesson that you're supposed to take? So these are the general questions that she's asking based on that particular incident. The backdrop is that incident. As I always say, that even though the questions are general, when given in the context of an incident like this, it gives us a better opportunity and the clarity is better when we get the backdrop of the question itself. So the first part of that question, or the first question that she raises there, is why do such bad things happen to us at all? Well, we all know the general answers to that, right? We say karma, or sometimes it's just practical reasons. We've not been careful, or we've trusted a person we probably should not have, right? It's very difficult for us to look at an incident like that and say that this is purely because of prarabdha karma. Or when we say prarabdha karma, it means, you know, from the many karmas of our past lives, we choose a certain karma to work out in the course of this lifetime, right? That's what we refer to as prarabdha, or what we refer to as destiny for this lifetime. It's very difficult to look at an incident and be sure that this is prarabdha. One of the ways of looking at it is when there is no reason for that to happen, when we have not harmed anybody, and if it happens, well, we can say that it is prarabdha. But sometimes even in the course of regular life, I think, we tend to do things which probably we could have been more careful, right? I am not, again, making a judgment of why this happened to this particular listener. I don't think I have enough details to say that for sure. I'm just saying that these are the different possibilities, right? Sometimes when something like this happens, I think you might have a flash of what could have led to this. Or many times it happens, when somebody speaks very harshly to us, suddenly a flash of, I spoke harshly to such and such a person, and this could be possibly a repercussion of that. Sometimes it comes as a flash why that's happening, but otherwise it's very difficult to say. So most often, I think the best way, the first step to do is do what is practically necessary to be done. Many, many months ago, I think many years, more than a year ago, one of the first few questions that are answered on the show was about an elderly listener who asked about a particular medical condition that she was undergoing. I think she had a renal failure or something like that. And she was asking, how do I know that this is karmic, or this is, something got to do with an ailment in the body which needs to be treated as such. And in the course of that answer, I'd explain this. It's very difficult for us to ascertain whether a certain problem we are going through is bad for us, or is it bad karma, or it's very difficult to say that, right? The reason why it doesn't matter, or it doesn't, why we are not given the knowledge of what karma has led to that particular problem, is most often our response to that situation is independent of whether it is karmic or otherwise, right? For that particular person, I said that you need to treat your disease as much as within your means you can handle your disease, or you can give medical treatment to your body. I think you should go ahead and do that. So similarly, any problem like this, our first response, of course, is to look at it practically and say that, okay, these are the lessons I learned. The next time I'm going to be careful. Or the next time if anybody asks for my advice, I'll tell them that, you be careful of these things. But why do we then talk about karma at all if karma is not necessarily featuring into our practical thinking or our practical response to a situation? I'll come to that, because it's a very, very important point why we think of karma and why karma plays a very important role even when we don't know the details of what has led to the current situation, right? But I'll come to that when I speak about karma, probably towards the end of the answer. Now, to the second question which was asked, or the second part of the question which was asked, is why do bad things happen in Swami's abode? This is something which anybody who goes through a bitter experience or an unpleasant experience in Swami's abode is very disturbed about. When you come to Swami, you come from the world outside, you meet all kinds of people and you undergo all kinds of problems. You don't expect to encounter them in Swami's abode when you come to Puttaparthi or when you come and stay in the ashram. Well, the simple answer to that, why do such things happen in Swami's abode? The reason is all kinds of people come to Swami, right? It's not that only good, noble, devoted people come to Swami. All kinds of people come to Swami. And whenever I look at situations like this, when I see people like this, I often remind myself of one misconception that we have when we look at Swami's ashram, right? We come with the belief that all in Puttaparthi or around Swami are like angels on earth, right? That is the conception with which we come. But the reality is, people here are not angels on earth, but they are all humans in heaven. I think that is a distinction which we have to keep in mind. That's something I always remind myself. I'll try and explain to you what I mean by this. When you say that the people around Swami are all angels, especially when you look at Swami's students, or you look at people who are very close to Swami, or even people who are, living in Puttaparthi for many years, when you think of them as angels on earth, that's when you kind of expect them to lead a life of much higher moral standards. But the fact is the other way around. All people around Swami are human, but they are living in heaven. And what does that mean? What do we mean by saying that these are all people that are living in heaven? When an avatar graces a particular place, you know, it becomes a very, very potent kshetra. You know, that's the word we use in Sanskrit. A kshetra is actually a place, but we use that word specifically to refer to a pilgrimage or a place of high spiritual potency because of the presence of a master or an avatar, right? So when God comes in the form, in a human form, and takes an avatar in a particular place, the place becomes very, very potent. And when we say that the place becomes very potent, what we mean is even the smallest act of goodness or selflessness which is performed in such a place is rewarded multifold, right? This is something which Swami has made references to. There are other people to whom Swami has said this in the interview room. Swami said, and that is what happens in Swami's presence or in Swami's kshetra. If you do any small bit of good act, it gets multifold. And I think this is a standard belief in, I think, most traditions. The reason why we have a lot of people soliciting alms outside temples or outside holy places like that, why you see that so rampant in India especially. The reason is this, that we have this belief that when you do any good act in a kshetra, in a pilgrimage, the reward that you get for that is multifold. But that also applies to doing mistakes or petty crimes, right? Even small mistakes that you do when you harm another person, when you cheat another person, the response to that, the karma to that is again magnified because this place is so potent. So that's why I'm saying that when you look at people around, when you look at people in Puttaparthi and Prashant Nilayam, it is not like these are all self-included. It's not like we are all angels on earth. In fact, it's the other way around. We are all humans living in heaven. And whichever place, wherever Swami is, that place is heaven, and we need to be very, very careful, right? So it's got nothing to do with Swami himself. As Swami would often say, you know, the sun shines for everyone. Someone chooses to do a daylight robbery, or someone chooses to do good acts under the sunlight, right? The sun shines for everybody. It does not discriminate between a good and a bad person. But according to the choice that you make, according to the decisions that you take of being good or being bad, you create your own destiny. The person who is living there creates his own destiny, right? So we can only feel sorry for people who come to a place like Puttaparthi and tend to misuse this opportunity. It's a very sad thing, because when you have the opportunity to live in Swami's presence or even visit Puttaparthi, or for whatever little time that you get to spend in Swami's presence here, I think you accrue that that opportunity because of the merit that has been earned in many, many lifetimes. So after coming that, if we misuse that, I think we can only feel pity for such people. And, you know, nothing more can be said about that. But to say that in Swami's presence these things are happening, I think that would be a result of our misconception and our expectation of this place. But yes, Swami's presence does attract goodness. I'm not saying that in Prashanti Nilayam or Puttaparthi is going to be exactly like the world outside. The kind of problems you face outside, you'll face here. It's not like that. Swami does attract goodness. In fact, Swami himself would say this, right? That my godliness has attracted the goodness in all of you. That's what has drawn you all to me. And Swami would say that if you wish to be drawn more to me, then you need to become more pure. It's like the iron filings getting rid of their dust and rust, and they getting attracted even stronger and more powerfully by the magnet, right? So it is not that people around Swami are not good. Swami does by nature attract goodness. So because of this attraction, we could say that the percentage of good people is more in Parthi, or the concentration of good people is probably high compared to elsewhere, because of this fact that Swami attracts goodness and people in Swami's presence are constantly endeavoring to purify themselves and improve their state of goodness, right? So that is the reason why there is a general amount of goodness here. And it is true, I think people like me who've lived here for close to two decades can vouch for this fact that there people in general are good in Puttaparthi. But we should also acknowledge that there are all kinds of people. And Swami would say that if you have a temple festival or what you call a Nutsavam or a Ratotsavam, you know, where there are these huge gatherings or like a Kumbh Mela or a Pushkaram, which is celebrated in Andhra, thousands and thousands of devotees gather to earn the grace of God because it's an important festival and it's an auspicious moment, right? But seeing the thousands and thousands gather, Swami would say that so many thieves and pickpockets and such people also come. So you come there seeking the opportunity of being close to Swami, but at the same time, there are many people who come seeing the crowds because that kind of crowd is an opportunity for them, right? So all kinds of people come, especially in Swami. We cannot deny the fact that there will be people with maligned intentions too. But forget those who have bad intentions and come to Swami. So many come to Swami even with intentions of using the opportunity in a very righteous manner, in a very legitimate manner, right? You look around in Puttaparthi, there are so many shops, there are so many businesses. So businessmen come, students come when Swami has set up a university. Not all students have really come drawn by Swami. Some of them have purely come for the education that Swami is offering. There are doctors who come who professionally wanted to serve in a hospital like this. They need not be necessarily, you know, devoted to Swami. So there are a lot of people who come here. They're not necessarily devotees, but once you come here, the opportunity to turn to Swami, the opportunity to align your life to expectations of Swami, I think that is there for everybody. And I think that is what makes the avatar special. When the avatar comes and when he sets up institutions like this, when Swami starts a Balvikas program or when Swami sets up a hospital, all of this is to give opportunity to people who belong to these various sections of life, be it students, be it professionals. All of these people get an opportunity to come close to Swami, and the opportunity to turn, to transform is given to everybody. Unfortunately, some people don't use it, right? That's a different thing altogether. And that is why as Swami's devotees, though we get very, very perturbed by the presence of such miscreants, especially when you go through an experience like what this listener has shared, it is very disturbing. It really puts us off. But we must also realize that Swami is meant for all people. As much as Swami's presence is to reward someone who is pious and noble, Swami's presence is also for people to transform from bad ways to good, right? And this has also happened. There are many, many stories of people who come here as thieves, have come here as people who wanted to, as Naxalites, as terrorists, and all kinds of people who have come here and transformed in Swami's presence. Or purely people who have come here with material intent have transformed after their association with Swami. So as an entity, as a personality, I think Swami will attract everybody. There is no way we can say that why are bad people around Swami, or why are people with cruel intentions or cunning intentions around Swami. I think as devotees, it is not for us to choose. It is for us to acknowledge that all kinds of people will be around Swami, and we have to accept that. As Swami would say many times, you have a pond. When the pond is full, yes, you will have lotuses there, you will have honeybees there, you will have butterflies, but you cannot deny the fact that there will be frogs and insects and all other unpleasant creatures too. And that's the nature of things, that the good will attract good, and when there is a lot of goodness in a certain place, it is an opportunity even for bad to come and, like in your case, you know, cheat people who are unsuspecting. So that's always there. But that does not always mean that all of us who are going to come here are going to get looted and cheated. I'm not saying that. It happens to some of us, and it happens sometimes even to those to whom it has happened. So what is the context in it happening to us? I think that's what we need to find out. Especially when we say that it has happened to us in Swami's presence, it has happened in Puttaparthi, it has happened in Prashanthi Nilayam, right? The question is, you know, why does it happen around Swami? And the fact is, Swami is everywhere. Because Swami is God, that is the reason we come to Him. So what is the idea behind anything unpleasant happening to our life? we are talking about unpleasant things happening in Swami's presence or in Puttaparthi. But the fact is, the moment you acknowledge Swami to be divine and omnipresent, any kind of difficulty we undergo, any kind of problem like this that happens to us, be it in our place, and you might be in America, you might be in Delhi, you might be in any corner of the world, but if something bad happens like this, we always tend to turn to Swami and say, Swami, why did this happen to me when you are there with me? Right? So it's very important to address that question. For the next few minutes, I'll speak a little generally about this concept of, how do we understand why such things happen to us? When something bad happens to us, when something unpleasant happens in our life, and especially, you know, when you've not harmed anybody, especially you've led a good life, you've led a noble life, why is it the first question that occurs to us is, why did this happen to me? Many times, if you observe ourselves, especially when something very unpleasant happens, even before asking the question of, what am I supposed to do? What is my next move? How am I supposed to react to the situation? One of the first questions we end up asking is, why did this happen to me? Right? I think there is a reason why this question comes up. And the reason for that is, nothing can give us as much solace as meaning and purpose can. You know, if we know that we are undergoing a certain problem for a certain reason, if we know the reason and the purpose behind undergoing it, and if we feel that this is going to eventually lead us to a certain goodness, or it is going to help us go to the next level or raise ourselves, then we feel calmed. It gives us a little bit of peace of mind that, so there is an idea behind this. It's not some random event which is happening to me, right? And that's the reason why when something unpleasant happens, we inadvertently ask this question, why? A very classic example that I always like to give in this context is, let's say that you are having some kind of a health problem and you go to a doctor and the doctor gives you a medicine, right? And you come back home, you take the medicine, and let's say that night you start getting high fever and you start getting stomach spasms or something, and you start panicking. You wonder what is happening. So you call up your doctor and you say that, doctor, this is what's happened. I took your medicine and I'm in such pain. And the doctor is very casual, and the doctor says, oh, it's all right. You're supposed to get that pain, and that's a sign that the medicine is working. Let's say he says that. So what happens to me when I hear that something like that is, it's not that my pain will go away instantly. It's not that I'm going to be calmed immediately, but definitely the idea that, okay, I'm undergoing this pain, but there is a reason why I'm undergoing this pain, and by undergoing this pain, I'm probably going to wake up tomorrow healthier and, you know, having got over this health issue, right? So that idea, even when we are going through pain, when we find that there is a purpose for what we are going through, it gives us a lot of calmness and solace, right? That is what we are after, and that is why we ask this question of why? Why am I going through this? Why am I doing this? In fact, this is probably how our entire life is guided. We don't realize this, but this is what defines our life. This question, this pursuit of why am I doing this, or what is the reason why I'm going through this? Let me explain it this way. When we are going through life, I think there are three types of fulfillments that we constantly seek. What I'm going to speak for the next few minutes might appear like completely out of the context of the question, but please bear with me for a few minutes. I probably will be able to establish the connection between what I'm saying now and then the question which was raised. So when we are going through life, we kind of have three types of fulfillment that we seek. One fulfillment is that which comes when we satisfy our senses, when we satisfy the physical body, when we eat, when we sleep, when we probably, respond to the desires of the senses. Right? There is a certain amount of happiness that comes. There is a certain amount of pleasure that comes. But that is probably the lowest level of fulfillment that we get. And one way of looking at it is, as they say, it is so much attached to what comes from outside that it becomes very, very ephemeral. When you get that input from outside, you get the fulfillment. And after some time, that fulfillment fades off, be that with hunger, be that with sleep, be that with thirst, all of these things, you need that stimuli from outside to make you feel fulfilled, right? So this is probably the lowest level of fulfillment that we seek in life. The second is the satisfying of the desires of the mind. When we like doing something, right, when we do something out of our fondness, the moment the mind gets attached, associated with something that we like, it becomes larger than just that of the senses. I will not go into this. I think I've spoken about this a couple of times in response to certain answers before. But simple thing, what you can think of is, you know, when you give a person a food item and he eats it, there is a certain amount of fulfillment. But the moment the food item that you're offering that person happens to be that person's favorite food item, then the mind starts associating with that act of eating, right? So the pleasure that the person feels is actually much more than just the pleasure he or she would get by satisfaction of the physical hunger, right? That's what the involvement of the mind does. So this is the second form of fulfillment, where we are trying to not satisfy merely the desire of the body and the senses, but we are trying to satisfy the desire of the mind. And this becomes even more pronounced, especially when you're talking about things that you like doing. Let's say that you like to sing, or you like to dance, or something like you're passionate about doing something. One of the examples they give is, let's say you're doing a work. It happens especially with people who are in the creative field of work. Let's say you're editing a video, or you're making music, you're composing music, and you enjoy doing that. You tend to get so lost in that act itself that very, very casually and without much effort, you tend to do away with the lower forms of fulfillment. And that is the reason when somebody is highly engaged in the work he or she is doing, they're able to forego sleep, they're able to forego hunger, and they're able to forego a little bit of the tiredness which the body undergoes. Because this is a higher level of fulfillment that you experience when you're going through this. So one level of fulfillment is the satisfaction of the desires of the physical body. The second level of fulfillment that we pursue in life is the fulfillment of the desires of the mind. The third level of fulfillment is when we do something and that thing that we are doing has a larger purpose, or it is more meaningful, right? Physically, it may not give pleasure. Sometimes even mentally, you may not like doing what you're doing, but there is a larger reason for that, and then you feel that it is worth doing. Probably the simplest example you can think of is a student who is preparing for an exam, right? Or somebody who is working under a very unpleasant or a nasty boss. Or think of when a person has to undergo something unpleasant or something as painful as a chemotherapy, right? When we know that our pain and suffering has a purpose behind it, it is not giving me fulfillment of the body. It is not giving me fulfillment of the mind. It's not something I'm liking to do. I don't want to go through that suffering. You know, it's not something that I enjoy doing, even from the point of view of the mind. But I still undergo it because I know that eventually there is something good waiting for me. It has a larger meaning to it, right? And this is the other form of fulfillment that we are constantly pursuing. And typical example of that is that of somebody who is undergoing a painful treatment like chemotherapy, or somebody like a diabetes patient who chooses to keep away from sweets. You know, that person likes the sweet. The person probably would enjoy the sweet if it is eaten. The body will respond to that input which comes from outside. And he or she does not want to stay away from sweets. But doing that act, even though it is not giving the fulfillment of the body and the mind, gives a larger fulfillment because there is a meaning to it, right? And this is the higher purpose that we always pursue. We don't really acknowledge it sometimes, but we are constantly doing that. Why are we sitting and studying when we like to play? Why are we sitting in an office when we probably like to be at home with our children? Because we know that there is a purpose for this act, and this purpose is larger, right? And when you're talking about meaning and purpose giving the third level of fulfillment, which is a little higher level of fulfillment, there are two ways we use it in our daily life, right? One is when we are conscious of the purpose, like all the examples that I gave you. where you consciously undergo a certain pain or a certain difficulty or a certain unpleasantness, knowing that I'm doing this because at the end of it, I'm going to gain something, right? The second is, I don't know the purpose myself, but I believe that there is a purpose and there is someone who knows what the purpose is and I trust that person, right? Or you say, I mean, the trusting the other person is actually the other level, where the second level is only when you are not aware of the reason why you are undergoing that pain, but you believe that there must be a reason, so I don't mind undergoing this. And I think this is where theories like the karma theory, or for that matter, any other philosophy which involves, involves points which are not cognizable to us, which are not obviously known to us, right? When you build a karma theory is all about, okay, you must have done something in your past. I don't know what it is, but I must have done something. But the idea that I'm going through a difficult phase, but there is a reason for it, and that reason is I'm using up my karma, or, you know, I would have done this to somebody in the past, and I'm having this opportunity to atone for it. This idea, even though I don't know the purpose, even a theory like this, which gives me an idea of purpose, actually gives me a little bit of calm. And it again goes back to that idea of, you know, speaking to the doctor with your, you're having high fever after taking the medicine. It does not mean that your physical pain is taken away, but it gives you a certain mental calmness to go through that pain, right? So that is the second one. When you don't know the purpose, but still the idea that there is a purpose gives you a little bit of calmness. The other way is the way for most of us devotees. And again, this is what will actually bring us back to the context of the question which was raised. That I may not know the purpose behind my suffering, but I know that there is someone, in this case, Swami, who knows what is the purpose behind what I'm going through, and I trust his wisdom. And that's what we call faith. Right? Faith is when you trust in a person, when you don't know or when you don't have concrete evidence to have that faith. Right? That's what faith is. I don't know how this is good for me. I don't know how this is going to help me. But Swami is making me go through this. So even if I don't know what the purpose is, I believe that Swami knows the purpose. Right? Especially when something happens right under Swami's nose. Right? Eventually, we should realize that whichever part of the globe you are, wherever something bad happens to you or good happens to you, it's under Swami's nose. It's not like only in Puttaparthi, it is right under Swami's care, why did this happen? No, wherever you are, I think this question is valid. When Swami is with me, why did this happen? And when this question comes, well, this is the higher level of fulfillment which is supposed to give us that solace. Yes, I don't know why I'm suffering. I don't know why I'm going through this. I don't understand why I'm doing this. But I believe in Swami. If Swami is making me go through this, there is a certain purpose for that. And as Swami would say, that constantly remind yourself that whatever happens is good for me. I don't know how it is good for me. I'm not in a position to reason out and tell these are exactly the reasons why it is good for me. But the trust that if Swami is allowing me to go through this, right, this is good for me. So when I get cheated or looted, say in Swami's presence or by someone associated with Swami, pain and hurt will be there, right? That's quite natural. The way the person who has asked the question has said, it's quite natural, especially, it is wrong to get attached to objects and materials that we have in our life, but it does happen. We can't say that none of us are attached to things like that. I mean, I might be attached to things which probably are associated with Swami, something which Swami has given me. But still it's a material, and if I'm going to get attached to that, it is attachment. So when we have any form of attachment, when something like this happens, it is going to be painful, it is going to hurt. But just like going through chemotherapy, that example, just because I know it is good for me, doesn't mean that the pain is going to go away, but it gives me the strength to undergo that particular period of pain, right? And in life, when we go through tough times, when we say, I don't know why, but Swami knows, if He is letting this happen, He must have a reason for it. To have that belief, to have that firm conviction that, you know, Swami is making this happen to me and it is acceptable to me, I think the prerequisites for having that idea, to have that thought is, one is the belief that Swami can handle such issues if he chooses to. That is faith in Swami's omnipotence, isn't it? Just like how the outrage in the question is because why did Swami let it happen? In that itself, there is the belief that if Swami wanted, he could have stopped it, right? So first and foremost, the belief that if Swami wishes, he could have stopped it. And the second is the faith in Swami's love. Faith that he loves me, but he still let this happen to me. So there must be a larger purpose. So the idea that Swami can avert it and Swami loves me enough to avert it, but still if he doesn't do it, there must be a higher purpose to it, right? But why is this attitude important? As I said, this is actually a sign of maturity. As I pointed out, there are three types of fulfillment. If we are going to be stuck in the level of fulfillment where pleasures to the body and pleasures to the mind, I think most of us are there, right? We want comfort for the body and we want what we think is good for us. We want what we think is right for us. What we have placed our mind on. Constantly, that's what we want. But if we are stuck to this, then that is the level of maturity we are in. If we wish to grow in our devotion, if we wish to progress in this path of spirituality, then you need to come to that third level of fulfillment where you are seeking fulfillment more from meaning and purpose rather than satisfaction of the desires of the body and the mind. Probably before I end, let me give you another example, which I don't know if you'll be able to relate to directly, but this example I'm giving you because it's very similar to another way Swami explains this whole thing. Let's say there is a person who's a daily wage worker, or he gets paid for how much of work he does. Whatever money he earns, he spends it on getting things for himself. He satisfies his desires and acquires comforts for the body. Then someone tells him that, you should start investing. And he asks, what is investment? He said, no, don't spend all the money that you have. Keep aside some money, and that money you can probably put it in a business or put it in a bank or put it in an FD or whatever it is. So what he does now is, it looks like he's sacrificing, right? He probably is a person, let's say he's a person who earns something like 10,000 per month. He starts living like somebody who earns 7,000 a month because he's putting away 3,000 rupees in the form of investment. So it appears like he is sacrificing, or he is controlling or curbing a certain amount of his desires. But what he is eventually doing is, he is in the process, his ability to fulfill his desires is actually going up. It's actually increasing. When the money comes back to him in the form of returns for investment, he's going to become richer, and his ability to fulfill his desires is going to become more. So from being a person who just uses whatever money is given to him just to fulfill his desires, that little bit of control and little bit of sacrifice, apparent sacrifice of not spending the money immediately that he gets and putting it aside, is actually giving him a higher quality of life, right? Now let's say that this person comes in contact with a spiritual master, and the spiritual master induces in him this idea that when you give in charity, you can be happy. When you let go of your money, you don't spend it on yourself. You don't put it in the bank so that you can spend it later. But you spend it on others when you're trying to help others, or when you let go of the money that you have. And let's say that through this, he discovers a higher level of happiness. And this is actually true sacrifice, right? The second appears like sacrifice. This is true sacrifice in the sense of monetarily, but eventually, if you look at it, it's not sacrifice, because he is giving money which is paltry and he is getting satisfaction or fulfillment which is so much more higher. But in the process, what does he realize? That the idea that I can find more happiness even when I'm giving away money which is not directly going to be used for my own fulfillment of desires, right? And such a person will still be happy when he's able to spend on his desires, but will be happy even when he lets go of money, right? So eventually, let's say that the person becomes a renunciant. You know, that's how the progression is given. When you are able to let go of all your possessions, the fulfillment that you can feel becomes infinite. right? When you're able to seek fulfillment in giving away or letting go, you find all happiness. And this is what I feel Swami is actually leading us all to. We have certain needs, we have certain likes and dislikes, and initially we come to Swami to fulfill these likes and dislikes, right? That's how we, most of us, come to Swami. But when with faith, when this faith that Swami knows what's best comes in, when that attitude comes, we start developing what we refer to as vairagya, right? And the more vairagya or detachment that you have, the more purposeful our life becomes. How does this vairagya come? When initially you come thinking that, you know, bad things should not happen to me, or I should not, my children should have good health, or my business should not go bad. But when you inculcate this attitude that whatever happens to me is good for me, now you have literally shielded yourself from certain reverses that you are likely to face in life. When something bad happens, to a certain extent you're able to say that, no, if Swami has allowed this to happen, then it is all right for me. I can put up with this. So automatically you are not as averse to a negative thing happening in your life as you were before. And this is what is referred to as vairagya or detachment, right? And more this vairagya comes, more and more you distance yourself from something pleasant or unpleasant. Your happiness is insulated from the events that happen outside. And that is when life becomes more purposeful. You are no more seeking your fulfillment from the satisfaction of your desires, but you're seeking your purpose from a sense of higher meaning, right? That's what you're looking at. You're just looking at life and saying that, okay, today something went right, it must be for my good. Tomorrow something goes wrong, this must be for my good. So you're constantly looking at the higher purpose that can be got from life. Well, all this does not mean that we go around in search of people who are going to cheat us and who are going to loot us. That is not the idea. Going back to what I started with, practically we must do what we must do. Some event like this happens, I think practically if we are supposed to take some cautionary measures, or if there is something that you need to do, you have to report it to the local authorities, or whatever needs to be done, I think still needs to be done. If somebody cheats you in this manner, or if somebody puts you through an unpleasant experience, that should make you practically wiser. We never take that out of the equation. That is why it is not only vairagya that's necessary in the spiritual path. You need vairagya and viveka, right? We always speak of them as a pair. Viveka and vairagya is required. So that viveka is partially this discrimination that comes from practically taking decisions based on what we experience in life. So that viveka is important, that we need to constantly keep taking. But this vairagya will, as Swami says, will raise us to a higher level of viveka or discrimination, which Swami refers to as the spiritual buddhi or the spiritual discrimination, right? Where you are able to raise yourself above the material pleasures and the material happiness, the happiness and sadness which comes to us in life, and you're able to raise your discrimination beyond this and look at life and say that, no, there must be a larger purpose to this, there must be a larger meaning to this, right? So to the question that, you know, why such things are happening in Swami's place, and, you know, Swami should first clean up his place, that's how some people put it, that why such people are there around Swami, in Swami's ashram sometimes, or in Swami's organization, and Swami's preaching others to transform themselves, is one way of looking at it. But, you know, Swami can clean up Puttaparthi in a trice if he chooses to. Forget Puttaparthi. He can ensure that the whole world is clean. He can ensure that nothing happens bad in our life. But probably that's not the way around. If that is what we want in life, that nothing bad should happen to us, I'm doing good and only good has to come back to me, and nothing unpleasant ever should happen in my life, then we are stuck up in the fulfillment of satisfying our physical desires and our mental desires. If we have to go to the higher level, Swami says that you need to have this attitude that if Swami is putting me through this, there must be a purpose for it and it must be for my good. Otherwise, Swami will not, loving me so much and having the ability to sort my life, will not let me go through something like this. And that is why Swami would say, do not seek that, oh, I should not have any problems. I think that's probably one of the unique things about Swami. Swami was very categorical in saying that it does not mean that when you come to me, all your problems will be solved. Don't think that the moment you come to me, all your worries will be gone. Swami said, don't even seek for that. Swami would say that pray for bhakti, right? Bhakti is devotion, that faith that Swami knows what is best for me. And Swami would say, ask for bhakti and ask for shakti, that strength to hold on to this belief, the strength to endure what you're put through. And Swami would say that bhakti and shakti will eventually lead you to mukti or liberation, which is what we are all seeking, right? So yes, it is absolutely undoubtedly unpleasant when something like this happens to us, especially in Swami's place. We come here literally to seek peace of mind, and when something like this happens to us, it does disturb us. But I think it is best for us to take it in our stride and look at it with a broader perspective in our mind, right? If in Swami's place it has happened, if Swami has allowed this to happen to me, what is the reason for that? Do take the practical measures that you need to do. As I always keep repeating on this program, you know, spirituality does not give you the license to be impractical. In fact, spirituality makes you more mindful and makes you more hands-on in dealing with the problems that you undergo, but with a maturity which only spirituality can get. You stand above your problems and you look at your problems and you find ways of solving them, right? So I thank the listener for asking this question. As I said, it's not something that we've not addressed on the show, but in the context of the question, I think it is a little different. But I hope those who felt that this is a repetition of what has been told before felt that it was a reiteration, it was worth listening to. And I thank the listener for the opportunity to do that again. With that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's show. If you have a question on practical spirituality or any situation like this that we dealt with today, feel free to write to me. I invite questions directly to my personal mail ID. My personal mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. The mails that you send to me are read only by me, so you can feel free to write to me. And if you wish to be anonymous, if you wish that your name should not be mentioned in the show, please let me know. If you can record the question in your own voice, and that would be wonderful. I'd love to play it in the voice of the person who's asking the question. You can send me your recording. Nowadays, it's very easy to record any small sound bites that way. I think any smartphone is good enough to do that. Feel free to record it and mail it to me. I have a few questions lined up. So if you send me a question, I think it'll take a little while before I can get to that. So be prepared to be patient if you send me a question. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I once again thank the listener who sent us the question for this week. I'm going to leave you with a very sweet Telugu song that I happened to come across a couple of days back. Very sweet words in Telugu. It's reference to Swami as a young Sai who was in Puttaparthi then. The whole song is about that. I hope you'll enjoy it. On the other side of the song, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and Sai Prakash for the last episode, the last segment of this week's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
చక్కని చిన్నోడంట పుట్టపర్తిలో ఉన్నాడంట సత్య సాయి వాణి పేరంట ఓ అమ్మలా చక్కని చిన్నోడంట పుట్టపర్తిలో